What's up, Pine Lake? Great to see you guys. My name is Mike Bro, in case we've never met before, and I have the privilege of being on the team around here. And I got to tell you how much I love coming here. Y'all make me feel so at home, like this, a home away from home. I love the team here. I love all y'all, and Madison, and Clinton, and Starkville, and Oxford, and the Res, and those of you that join us online, grateful you're here as well this weekend. We're in this series that we're calling Enough, where we kind of kicked off the new year wrestling with some questions that we all wrestle with. Questions like, have I done enough was week one. Have I done enough? I mean, what do I need to do to get God to love me, or at least like me, or at least have him quit being ticked at me? Well, tell me what I need to do. How do I measure up? Give me the get into heaven checklist, and I'll just do it. Well, week one, we learned that it's not about what we have to do. It's all about what Jesus Christ has already done for us, and that what he has done on a cross is enough. In week two, we asked the question, am I enough? We talked about who we are in God's eyes, that over all the voices telling us that we don't measure up, that we are not enough, there is one voice that cuts through all the lies, all the noise, and tells us that we are accepted and lavishly loved. And I'm telling you, when you know that to the core of your being, it's an absolute game changer in your life. A couple of weeks ago, we said that we all, from time to time, have to ask ourselves, have I had enough? Like, am I sick and tired of being sick and tired? Am I ready to walk away from that empty old life? Am I completely ready to surrender and give up all the stuff that's just making me miserable and finally allow God to transform me this year into somebody that's brand new? Then last weekend, if you're here, you know, we wondered out loud together, is God's grace, is it really enough? Because, man, this life can get hard, can't it? And we all wonder from time to time, am I going to make it through this tough thing I'm going through? And Chip last week talked about this guy named Paul who wrote a lot of the New Testament of the Bible, who in the middle of his suffering in a jail cell found that God's grace, it really, really is enough. And whatever you might be going through right now, we learn his grace will be enough for us as well. So if you missed any of the first few weeks of the series, I encourage you to go online and catch up. As always, Chip has unpacked some really, really helpful stuff. And today, we're asking the question that most of us continually ask in this culture. And the question is this, do I have enough? You know, Jesus talked about this one a lot. In fact, did you know that Jesus talked about money, stuff, materialism, more than he did about prayer, faith, sex, heaven, and hell combined? And he did because he knows how it can affect our anxiety levels and rob our peace, how it can even make us proud and arrogant, how it can inflame our envy toward other people and get us living in that stupid comparison trap and steal our heart away from God. So since it's a question that we all wrestle with, and since it is such a big deal to Jesus, we thought we probably ought to talk about it in this series at least a little bit and just ask the question, do I really have enough? And the way I want to approach it today is I want to expose some myths that really derailed me through my life and have derailed countless other people as well. And then I would like to apply some of God's opposing truth, and maybe when all is said and done at the end of our time this weekend, we'll all be able to start saying with deep contentment, you know what? Yeah, I do. I really do have enough. Well, the first myth that we buy into is this myth. It's all mine. It's all mine. Anybody else besides me ever bought into that myth? It's the thinking that says, I earned it. I made it. I own it. After all, it's like my name on the paycheck. Along with that comes what we might call a consumption assumption. Like everything is placed in my hands for my consumption. And I've just learned that if you and I look at money like that, we'll most likely become very impulsive spenders. You know how it goes? Your appetite starts screaming, oh yeah, oh, I got to have that. And I got to have that now, because our appetites rarely scream, wait, right? They always say, get it right now. And we say, oh man, I want that. That's that right there, that's what I have been missing. I could see myself in that. In fact, I deserve that. I'm not going to wait on that. I'm going to get that right now. And from my own experience, our consumption assumption leads us down the pathway of I'll pay for it later kind of thinking. And pretty soon you find yourself scrambling to move all kinds of stuff around in order to cover all the bills. And if you're married, then you start hiding things from each other. And then the resentment starts to build and the trust level wavers and the fighting gets more and more intense. And before you know it, you've let something like money come between the two of you. And it all started by falling for the myth of it all belongs to me. So here's the counter to that myth. Here's the truth about it, really. The truth is, it's all God's. It's all God's. God owns it all. And I can't tell you how much that simple truth has changed my life, my perspective on stuff. Anybody right now have a kid in their house learning how to drive? Anybody got one of those? Let's just pray for every hand you see right now. Tough, tough season of life. But when my kids started to learn how to drive, I entrusted my car with fear and trembling to them. My name was on the title of that car. There was never any question. I could take back my car at any time for any reason. They had responsibilities while driving my car, but I maintained the rights of ownership. In the same way, every single possession that I have, including, quote unquote, my car, really belongs to my dad. My father, God holds the title on all my stuff. I might possess a lot of things, but I own absolutely nothing. So Psalm 24 reminds us, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. And when you come to understand that, man, it frees you up to live life. I just want to say something for a second. I love the fact that so many of you are catching that. Pine Lake is one of the most generous places I've ever seen in my life. In fact, this past Thursday, I was with a group of guys, and we were talking about y'all. We live out in Ventura, California, and wildfires hit a year ago and wiped out a lot of homes. And the first church to respond was Pine Lake. I mean, the day after the fires, we received this enormous check, this generous check that was used, all of it used, to help people that have been displaced and lost everything. And the way you all live beyond yourself, I got to tell you, is really inspiring. The whole Love First initiative, the whole making room, it has just been phenomenal to watch. I mean, y'all remind me of a time in the Old Testament of the Bible. There was this like huge outpouring of gratitude and giving that the nation of Israel expressed toward God. And afterwards, their leader, King David, says this. He says, "But Lord, who am I and who are my people that we should be able to give as generously as this? Everything comes from you, and we have given you only what comes from your hand." James chapter 1, verse 17 reminds us, every good and perfect gift, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. The Apostle Paul, that guy that Chip talked about last week, he writes to this young pastor, a guy he was mentoring, a guy he was kind of coaching, a guy named Timothy. You ought to read the letter he wrote to Timothy. He wrote a few of them there in the back of the New Testament. But he says, listen, Timothy, whenever you get a chance to teach, I want you to make sure when you're teaching those who are rich in this world, teach them not to be proud and not to put their trust in money, which is so unreliable. Their trust should be in God, who richly gives us all we need for our enjoyment. He said, listen, it all comes from his hand, because he owns it all. He richly gives it to us to use for his good and his glory, and, did you catch it? Also for our enjoyment, because good dads do that with no guilt trip attached. They love to see their kids enjoy stuff, but we really own nothing. We are simply managers of what the owner has given us. As a bonus, I've also learned that since it's his anyway, it frees me up to let him take back whatever he wants, whenever he wants it. It enables me to say, God, guess what? Your old car just broke. God, your furnace, it's yours, just went out. God, your jeans are getting a little too tight, need a new pair. This principle allows me to see that every spending decision is a spiritual decision, that there's nothing more spiritual about tithing than buying a car or buying a house or taking a vacation or going to the grocery store or buying clothes or paying taxes or paying off debt. I'm using His resources to do all of that. Now, I have a great deal of latitude in how I use it, but it's still His. And I'm going to have to give an account someday of how I managed His stuff. Myth number two is this: when I have more, then I'll be happier. I'm just looking for a little more. If I just had a little more, then I know I could be happier. We all get seduced by the myth of more, don't we? We look around at what other people drive, what they wear, what their kids get to do, the places they get to go on vacation, the nice HGTV homes they live in. We scroll through our social media feed, looking at the highlight reel of other people's lives, and we become discontent with our own life. We start living with this sense of scarcity, that we don't have enough, that somehow our life is not enough, that we are not enough. So we start chasing all kinds of stuff to kind of fill that I don't have enough hole in our heart, and we start to buy stuff that we can't afford with money that we don't have to impress people we don't even really know or like, and we start making some really dumb financial decisions thinking that more is what I need. It's going to make me happier. Gang, we all wrestle with this. You know how sometimes a story happens in your life that just marks you for the rest of your life? Happened to me when my kids were little. I'm a young dad. I was actually a student ministry pastor at the time, and I wanted to take a vacation with our crew. And so we saved a bunch of money, and we went to Hilton Head, South Carolina. Anybody been to Hilton Head? I'm talking about really cool place on the East Coast. And we're driving around, and I was young, and we had this really old beat up station wagon. Anybody ever owned a station wagon before? You know what those are? Had the seat facing backwards where the kids could see where you've been. It wasn't safe at all, but we loved it. They would roll around in the back. It was crazy. But it was all beat up station wagon. It had a car top carrier on top with all of our luggage. I mean, I looked like Clark Griswold going on vacation. So we're driving through Hilton, and I couldn't help but notice that everybody there, it seemed like anyway to me, had a much nicer car than me, like a much nicer car. And we went in this exclusive place on Hilton Head called Harbor Town. It's got the famous lighthouse there on the harbor. They got $20 million yachts parked in the harbor, all these beautiful condos, and everybody, it seemed like to me, drove a super nice car. I felt so out of place driving around that place. And I started, honestly, get a little envious, living with a little sense of scarcity, like I don't have enough. So we get there, and we think we got some ice cream cones and something. We sat down they got like an outdoor amphitheater, and there's a show getting ready to start. This guy comes out, still think they do it, still today. He comes out with a guitar, he starts singing, and all the kids that are there on vacation or living in the condos, they come up on stage, and I notice they all got these really nice, you know, matching outfits and stuff, and they go up on the stage, and I look around, and my kids are gone. I thought, oh no, they're up on stage too. They're up there with the rest of the kids, and they're not dressed like the rest of the kids. And the guy goes, okay, who wants to sing a song tonight? And I see this little chubby hand fly up. Like, oh. You know, you ever a teacher, you got a kid doing that in class? And you go, okay, you. So he goes, okay, you. And my son, Derek, is 5 years old, stands up. And I go, oh, no. And Derek was always a stocky little kid. And he was sunburned, had freckles everywhere, and he had a fresh buzz haircut. Had an old pair of shorts and a Milligan College t-shirt with a big hole in the middle of it. And he stands up, got sand all over because we just come from the beach. He stands up in the middle of all these really nice dressed kids and stuff, and the guy goes, wow, you're a big one. Derek goes, yep. He said, what's your name? He goes, Derek. He says, he looks him over, he goes, where are you from? He goes, Kentucky. The guy goes, oh, like that explained it or something. I don't know what he meant by that. And he goes, where'd you get that haircut, Derek? He goes, I don't know. He goes, come on, where'd you get the haircut? Are you in the Marines? He goes, no. So where'd you get your haircut? And in front of all these wealthy people, Derek says, my pappy cut it with the dog clippers. And it was true. We did. We left on vacation. Barbershop was closed. Just buzzing with the dog clippers. Buzzed his head, you know. I was so embarrassed. I wanted to crawl under the seat as people are looking for his poor parents, you know. And then the guy goes, what song you want to sing? And Derek goes, all my exes live in Texas. And he sang it and brought the house down, won the talent show that night. And you know what the prize was? A new t-shirt. I think they just felt sorry for him and gave him a shirt. I laughed all the way back to the car. The next day, I'm laying on the beach, and I just start cracking up, laying there thinking about what had happened. And I thought to myself, you know what? I'm loaded. I don't need the yacht. I don't need the fancy condo or the car. I'm already rich, man. I got kids that love me, love God, love each other. I really do, like, have enough. And gang, I think back to moments like that, and I look at today and see how good God has been to us. And Deb and I have more than we ever imagined in our life. But I got to be honest with you. We're no more happy now than when we drove that old junky station wagon. Ate lots of peanut butter, ramen noodles, anything you could make out of cheap ground beef. Pretty much wore the same stuff all the time. Dipped into what little savings we had to pay for our kids' ear infections. I mean, things were tight, but we were super happy and extremely blessed. And even these days, man, you probably eat more almond butter than I do peanut butter these days, and more grilled chicken than ground beef, but I still rotate about 6 hoodies with 5 pairs of shorts and 2 pairs of jeans. Because through the years, we've just learned, yeah, we got enough. We're rich. Trying to learn what Paul wrote from a prison cell in Philippians 4. We've seen this before, but he said, you know, I've just learned how to be content with whatever I have. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I have learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it's with a full stomach or an empty stomach, with plenty of food or a little food. I can do everything through Christ because he is better than all these things. He gives me the strength. In one of, remember the Peanuts cartoons? Remember those Charlie Brown and Linus and those guys? In one of his classics, Charles Schulz's cartoons, he's got Snoopy laying on the top of his doghouse. And Snoopy's all upset because Charlie Brown and the rest of the crew are all enjoying Thanksgiving dinner, a huge turkey dinner. And Snoopy is stuck on top of the doghouse with dog food. And he reflects a little bit and he says to himself, you know what? It could be worse. I could have been born a turkey. Now, if you don't take anything else away from the day, I want you to take away these 4 words. It could be worse. Let's just, because I want us to remember these, let's just say that out loud together. Ready? Here we go. It could be worse. Let's say it again. It could be worse. Now, when you leave here and you go out to the parking lot searching for your car, and when you get there, you're tempted to think as you look around, man, I wish I had that car over there or that truck over there or that van over there. I wish I had a nicer car, a newer car, a more expensive car. If I could get a car like that, I would be content. But today at least, when you walk out there, you're going to look at your car and you're going to say these 4 words, it could be worse. And when you drive it to wherever you live, your apartment, your house, your condo, your townhouse, your dorm room, wherever it is, when you get to the door, when you put your hand on the doorknob, you're going to be tempted to think about somebody else's home. You're going to be tempted to think, you know what, if I just lived in another place that was bigger, nicer, newer, more expensive, with granite countertops and stainless steel appliances or gated, then I would be content. Then I would have enough. But today at least, when you get home and you put your hand on that doorknob, you are going to say with great conviction, it could be worse. Tomorrow morning when you wake up and you roll over, you look at your spouse, you're going to... No, don't do that. Don't take it that far, okay? Jesus lovingly warned us. He said in Luke 12, he said, listen, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed because a person's life does not consist... A person's life does not consist, has nothing to do with the abundance of your possessions. But when you live with a heart full of gratitude and contentment, recognizing it all comes from His gracious heart and His gracious hand, when you're genuinely thankful every day for what you already have, it helps you recognize that myth of more for what it is. And you start to learn the truth. And here's the truth. Money can't buy happiness. I know that sounds super cliche, right? But it's true. Money can't buy happiness. The richest man who ever lived was a guy named King Solomon. You ought to read his journal sometime. It's in the Old Testament part of the Bible. It's called Ecclesiastes. And in his journal, he kind of chronicles his life and all the bad decisions he made. And he talks about how he amassed all kinds of silver and gold and real estate projects and entertainment things. He said, I denied myself no pleasure. Dude never looked at a price tag his entire life. And he looked around at all that he had. He said, it's all so meaningless. Just like chasing the wind. Now, I want to be very careful about saying this because I'm not saying that to be ambitious or effective or wealthy and or successful is a bad thing. Please hear me on that. We are all called to do the best we can with whatever gifts and talents we have been given. So it can and should be a good pursuit to earn, to accomplish, to achieve. Should be healthy desires that our Maker has placed within us. You and I are charged to enrich the lives of other people and make a difference in this broken world while we are here. And I know so many people who just are good at what they do, and they generously share their wealth to make a lasting difference through investing in the things of God. But I think there is a lesson that our society as a whole just has to learn. I text my son, Drew, last night. I said, what are you doing? He says, well, we're playing Monopoly. You ever play Monopoly? I started laughing because it gave me a flashback. I said, Drew, I'm going to talk about that this weekend. When we were playing Monopoly when we lived out in Vegas. Drew was a second grader, and my other kids were a little older, and we were all playing Monopoly together. I was killing them. I mean, just killing them. It's really something to cheat your seven-year-old out of Boardwalk. It is just something about it. And the other kids were getting mad at me because Drew, he's a second grader, and just ruthlessly and relentlessly, I'm saying, hey, I'll give you Baltic Avenue for all four railroads. The kids are going, don't do it, Drew. He's cheating you. I said, Drew, you love purple. It's a purple piece of property. He goes, okay. And they give me I was just killing them. I was just wiping them out. And I had hotels on everything. And somewhere between like Marvin Gardens and Pennsylvania Avenue, I looked at my kids, all losers, every one of them. I had destroyed them financially and psychologically. They're probably in counseling today because of that game. But I looked at all my railroads, all my hotels, all my utility companies, my huge pile of money. And the game is over, and one of my kids walking in the kitchen said, Dad, you can put it all back in a box. The same guy, Solomon, who tried to buy happiness, wrote this in Ecclesiastes 5:10. He says, he who loves money, never going to have enough. The foolishness of thinking that wealth brings happiness. And then he writes this in Proverbs 1:19. When you grab all you can get, that's what happens. The more you get, the less you are. And that's just tragic for our soul, tragic for our relationships. And Jesus asks us, how far do you have to walk down that road before you see where it leads? Surely you understand, he says, that it will never be enough and that in the end it all goes back in the box. Myth number three, we'll just simply call this the freedom card. I can remember getting my very first one. I still get them, those letters, where on the outside of the letter it says you are approved. I remember getting it going, wow, me? I've been searching for approval all my life. Thank you. You want to set me free at 21% APR. Thank you so much for seeing that I'm worthy. I feel so validated. This could be my unlimited passport to all the places I've ever dreamed about going, all the things I never thought I'd be able to do. It's a myth. It's a mirage. You know what simile is? Anybody know what simile is? Maybe some of you are English majors or maybe you're a writer. You understand the use of simile in constructing a sentence where you're trying to describe like this is like this. I ran across some actual college student attempts at using simile. These are classic. She caught your eye. Like one of those pointy hook latches that used to dangle from screen doors and would fly up whenever you banged the door open again. That's simile. The little boat gently drifted across the pond, exactly the way a bowling ball wouldn't. Attempted simile. Don't use this line. Her hair glistened in the rain like nose hair after a sneeze. This is one of my favorite ones. Long separated by cruel fate, The star-crossed lovers raced across the grassy field toward each other like two freight trains, one having left Cleveland at 6:36 p.m., traveling at, you ever seen the ACT test, you know exactly what this guy was talking about. This, I love this one. John and Mary had never met. They were like two hummingbirds who had also never met. I like this one. Her vocabulary was as bad as like, whatever. Here's one more. Debt crashed down upon them and buried them alive like an avalanche on a cold, dark mountain. I wrote that one. I've been there, and if you have too, you know it's not real funny. Money is a slippery slope to navigate anyway. When you were snowed under an avalanche of debt, there's this feeling of desperation that can absolutely smother you, overwhelm you, and make you feel like you've been buried alive. So here's the truth about that freedom card. Debt actually robs your freedom. I mean, the Bible is really clear about this. In Proverbs 22, verse 7, it says the borrower is actually slave to the lender. I'm sure you know by now that financial problems are the number one reason for divorce in our country. Number one, the bills mount up. You feel like you can't breathe. Panic sets in. You can't sleep. You can't stop worrying. You can't be generous. You can't enjoy the occasional night out because you're so buried in debt. It's an awful feeling, and it's not a pressure that God intended for any of us to feel. Now, if you are feeling that buried alive pressure, and I want to encourage you because I've been there. There's hope. There is hope. But you're going to have to do some work, and you're going to have to get proactive about changing the situation, and it's not too late to make some changes. And Debbie and I could both tell you, God will help you. He will help you dig out from under it. And if you're married, you've got to sit down and talk honestly about your current situation. Sit down without blame, without pointing fingers, and just say, you know what, we're in this together, and we are going to dig out together. And face the facts. Don't sugarcoat it. Don't try to wish it away. Just do the honest math and face the honest facts and just take ownership of the reality and ask for help. There's all kinds of smart people around Pine Lake that can help. And starting this weekend, you really ought to check out Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University. We've made all of our kids go through it. It's so helpful, very informative. It's a lot of fun, and you will learn some great guiding principles that are based on God's truth. But just start somewhere. Get a plan. It's going to take a while to dig out. It involves some very non-glamorous things like sacrifice and delayed gratification and self-control and character. But you know what? That's the kind of lasting stuff God wants to build inside of us anyway. Can I just get something off my chest just for a second? A lot of people in our culture want to get freed up financially fast. They want to skip all the hard work, all the sacrifice, the wise planning, the financial counseling, the workshops, all the character stuff, and just look for like the quick fix. I have lived among the video poker and blackjack addicts of Las Vegas. I've stood in line at a convenience store with a guy spending $100 on lottery tickets while he put $5 of gas in his car that had 3 or 4 hungry kids sitting in it. I grew up in the home of a compulsive gambler who had racing forms all over the backseat of his car and placed a call to a bookie every day of his life for decades. And I, as a kid, lived in the uncertainty of all that brought into our house. I have watched grown men take fantasy football to a whole nother level in hopes of hitting it big. I've seen people spin the high-risk wheel of the stock market only to sink further into despair. I've watched men and women sink their money into all kinds of get-rich-quick schemes and lose everything they have. And I always ask myself, why do people do that? Why do they want to get rich quick? You know why? Because getting rich quick requires no character. We reason, why should I enroll in character development school when I could just pick the Powerball or guess the point spread? Proverbs 21:5 says, good planning and hard work, they lead to prosperity, but hasty shortcuts, they just lead to poverty. So as you consistently work a plan and manage your money and honor God, He develops priceless things like trust and faith and contentment and confidence in His ability to sustain you and do miracles in your life. And gang, Publishers Clearinghouse is not going to show up on your porch and tell you any of that stuff. One more myth. When I have more, then I'll be generous. When I have more, then I'll be able to be generous. That sounds right, doesn't it? But you know what? Stats certainly don't back that up. Most people in our country who make more actually give away less. People who make over $200,000 a year give considerably less to charitable causes. You see, it's possible to be loaded on the outside, pretty empty on the inside. There's something that I've seen play out in just about every single mission trip I've ever been on. If you've ever been on a mission trip, you know what I'm talking about. If you ask a poor person in that country to give you something or to loan you something, they are so cheerfully open-handed. They're so generous. You ever experienced that? Why is that? I think it's because they don't live with the myth that their hope is attached to their stuff. But rich people, and I'm talking about all of us who live in this country, we can let our hope drift. Our hope can drift toward the type of thinking that says the rich think their wealth as a strong defense. They imagine it to be this high wall of safety. And if you and I allow wealth instead of God to be our source of safety, our source of security, then our hope is going to drift toward wealth. And here's what's going to happen. You're going to feel compelled to hoard your stuff because there will never be enough. You can't truly be generous because you're always building this imaginary high wall of safety. And every time you get to a certain number and think, okay, that's it, the wall is finally high enough, then you read the headlines and go, oh no, but what if that happens? And gang, that's a terrible way to live your life. And sometimes we don't even see it happening in us. Our hope just starts to shift. You see, I think most people have it exactly backwards. Instead of, oh, when I have more, then I'll be generous. Here's the truth. When I'm generous, then I'll have more. That's the truth. When I'm generous, then I'll have more. More peace, more joy, more contentment, more satisfaction, more freedom, more stories of life change, even more resources from God to give away. It's just the way it works. I went into a really cool candy store not long ago called Rocket Fizz. Y'all have been to a Rocket Fizz? Kind of old school candies like Sugar Daddies and things like that. They got all kinds of old craft sodas, and it's a cool store. And my wife loves these little caramel candies with the white center. Anybody else like those things? I think they're gross, but she loves them. And so I went in to get her a bag, and they had a deal where you could take a bag and get as many as you can in the bag, and it was the same price. So I am stuffing these caramel things down in this bag. I'm shaking it, stuffing it. It's overflowing. I had to walk really slow to the register so I wouldn't spill any of them. And as I looked at my bag, no kidding, right there at the counter, I thought of the words of Jesus when he said, just give and you'll receive. Your gift will return to you in full. Press down, shaking together, press down, shaking together, press down, shaking together, making room for more. In fact, it'll be running over, poured into your lap. The amount you give will determine the amount that you get back. It's true. Years ago, Debbie and I decided to get on what some refer to as the 10-10-80 plan. Probably many of you live this way, where you just pay God the first 10%, then you pay yourself the second 10%, put it in savings, and then live on the remaining 80%. Just train yourself to live on what you got. Or think of it this way, like give, save, and live. So we started reading things as we were digging out from under all the debt. We started reading things like Proverbs 3:9, honor the Lord, but it's giving him the first part of your income. So we just decided as a young couple, we're just going to do that. That's just going to be our preferred lifestyle right off the top. We're just going to honor God with the first 10% at least of our earnings, not in some legalistic, obligatory way, but just out of gratitude for how much he has blessed us. And we didn't want to give so much to a place as from a place. See, the Bible says when you honor God with your first part, whatever percentage that is, you invite him into your financial life. And he will engage himself supernaturally in your financial affairs. And when we don't do that, you know what God says? Said, come on, you're robbing me. God says, no, don't get me wrong. I don't need your money. But you're robbing me of the opportunity to get involved in your life. You're robbing me of the chance to prove to you how much I care for you. You're robbing me of the chance to demonstrate my love and my faithfulness to you. You're robbing me of the chance to fill you up with peace and contentment. You're robbing me of the opportunity to touch somebody else's life through your generosity. See, generosity doesn't happen until you and I decide, you know what? That's just my preferred lifestyle. I want to be a generous person. I want to honor God with my resources. I just want to touch the lives of other people while I'm here on this planet. I want to experience the truth of Jesus' words when he said, listen, it's a lot more fun to give than it is to even receive. And over the years, I have learned that gratitude and generosity just loosens the grip that money has on my life. It exposes all these things for myths. It keeps me out of that comparison trap. It manages my impulsive appetites. It refocuses my priorities in life. And if you're in a relationship, it kind of makes you work together as a team to accomplish eternal good with what God has given you. I'm telling you from experience, it's just a blast to live this way. One last word that Paul gives that young guy, Timothy, that he was mentoring. He said this, when you're teaching, tell them to use their money to do good. In fact, they should be rich in good works and generous to those in need, always being ready to share with others. If they will do this, they will be storing up their treasure as a good foundation for the future so that they may experience life that is true life. So God says, hey, married people, single people, dating people, divorced people, young people, old people, you matter to me. My son paid an enormous price to set you free. He paid your sin debt in full. He died to give you true life. He went to a cross to set you free from guilt and remorse and fear and worry and anxiety and greed and envy, all that junk. And if the Son shall set you free, you shall be what? Free indeed. Free spiritually, free relationally, free emotionally, free financially. And then God will give you a solid rock to build your life upon. You see, Jesus Christ, he's the more that we're all looking for. In fact, he's more than enough. More than enough. Let's pray together. Father, just so grateful for the way you've blessed my life. And God, even if I didn't have a dollar to my name, I would hope I'd be able to say the same thing. Like Paul, I've just learned to be content with whatever. Just really grateful for rescuing me from all the lies and myths that were told in this world, setting my feet on the right path so I could experience life to the full. And God, I think you've done that in a lot of lives in this place. It's obvious you have. God, there's some of us we're just catching on. We're just learning, and just help us take the next step. And Jesus, today we just thank you especially for taking care of all the debt our sin had racked up, for going to a cross and paying it in full. And because of what you've done, which is enough, we're going to get to be to heaven someday. So grateful for that. So I pray all this in your name, Jesus. Amen.